Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Has this ever happened to you?
My credit card company just sent me a letter stating that they're going to raise my interest rate significantly for absolutely no reason other than the fact that they can.
Some people are at the mercy of their credit card companies, in a hole they can't dig out of.
When you load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt.
Until now, there wasn't much you could do about rising interest rates on your cards or special fees. Until now, credit card companies made all the rules.
St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go.
But as of today, the souls of Americans are redeemed. A new law now stands between you and credit card doom. But is it strong enough to exorcise the demons of high-interest credit cards?
I owe my soul to the company store.
We'll find out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 22nd. I'm Celeste Headlee here with Todd Zwillick, who is filling in for John until Thursday.
Yep. Morning, Celeste. Well, let's get right to some of the top stories we're following this morning. For the first time, we're going to hear details of President Obama's plan to overhaul health care. They'll be posted on the White House website at 10 Eastern this morning. And beyond what's been talked about for the past year, the president plans to try to give federal authorities the power to deny rate hikes by insurance companies. This comes ahead of Thursday's televised summit with Republicans over health policy. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell tells Fox News he hopes the meeting won't be a waste of time.
They're going to lay out the plan they want to pass 4 days in advance, and what are we discussing?
Now, at the meeting, the president is expected to point out that Republicans have supported individual elements of the Democrats' bills.
New credit card rules go into effect today, as we said. Your next statement will show exactly how much your card costs to use and how long it'll take to pay off the balance if you make the minimum payment. For more, we're joined now by Takeaway contributor Alvin Hall, the host of the new BBC World News TV series, Alvin's Guide to Good Business. Alvin, so we'll now know exactly how much we're paying, but will the new law regulate ballooning interest rates?
The government did not limit the interest rates that they can charge on a credit card. It limited what they can charge you if you meet your payments for a period of time. So let's say you get a credit card with a teaser rate. That rate must stay the same for at least a year. They can only raise your rate if you miss a payment up to 60 days. Then they can raise it to whatever they want to. If you don't want it raised, you can then agree to pay down the balance at the old rate and cancel the credit card.
And we're going to talk more about those confusing rules with Alvin in just a moment.
Now, last night at the Winter Olympics, it wasn't quite the miracle on ice, but for the first time in 50 years, the United States has beaten Canada in Olympic hockey. U.S. forward Paul Stastny says the 5-3 win was especially sweet.
It's something people have been talking about since the schedule came out, and to get the win, I think, is huge for us. So we're excited, and now we're just going to get focused on the next game.
American skier Bodie Miller also won his first gold medal yesterday. We'll have more on the Winter Games and U.S. hockey's big night in just a few minutes.
Asian markets are up, European indices are mixed, and futures are up as well. The Dow's going to start at 10,402, the S&P opens at 1,109, and the NASDAQ starts at 2,243. Well, it's Monday. That means we're going to be talking about families, and today a topic that hits close to home for me, at least, blended families. My family's going to grow by two this summer, and we're going to have to talk about how you can successfully merge not just parents, but kids.
Now, we're also starting a new series this week we're calling Frustration Nation. We'll examine the gridlock in Washington and in Congress and the roiling anger from voters. Are you frustrated with how the government's running in Washington? Rebecca in Northville, Michigan, emails us, and she says, I am simply disgusted with everyone in Washington and could care less about their political affiliation. So my takeaway in just six words, clean out the House and Senate. Well, do you think Washington is dysfunctional, or are you happy that some people are slowing down the president's agenda? Tell us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to the website, which is thetakeaway.org. You can get creative, and if you feel like Rebecca, tell us how to fix the problem. Coming up next, credit card frustrations. Will they go away with new rules that are taking effect today? We'll ask some financial experts in just a few minutes.
Do you ever look at the back of your credit card bill and get completely confused by all that tiny print? It may get easier today, maybe not. The new law takes effect. It's called CARD, or the Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure Act. President Obama signed this law back in April.
Mysterious fees appear on statements. payment deadlines shift, terms change, interest rates rise, and suddenly a credit card becomes less of a lifeline and more of an anchor.
So, is this law going to fix all of that that the president talked about? Here to sort it out for us is our takeaway contributors and personal finance experts, Beth Koblinder. Good morning, Beth.
Hi.
Good morning. And Alvin Hall rejoins us.
Good morning.
Beth Koblinder, let's ask you first. Do you think this bill is actually going to help consumers in real, tangible ways?
I really think it will. I mean, it's interesting because I've been doing this for 20 years, and this is the first time we have really any meaningful legislation when it comes to credit cards, and Congress and senators have been talking about this for so long. And it really did take President Obama, when he came in and he was so popular, to kind of move this along. Things have changed since, but at the time he really did use a lot of political capital to make this happen. But now everybody's writing about, oh, it's not good in this way and it's not good in that way. But I think the real takeaway this morning is there are a lot of good changes in here that people want to pay attention to. Because if you just say, oh, well, it doesn't have this and it doesn't have that, you're going to miss the bottom line, which is there are a lot of ways to save yourself money
if
you know the new rules.
Let's get into those. Let's give me the two most important changes you think that'll help people out.
I think one of the most important is that if you're under 21 years old now, you won't be able to get a credit card unless you have a job. That's a new concept. Or you have a parent co-sign your credit card. Up until now, college kids have been bombarded with credit cards. They have, on average, $4,100 in credit card debt. That's not going to happen anymore. The other big one is what Alvin was saying before. They can't raise interest rates on debt you've already racked up, except if you're late by 60 days. So if you have a credit card that has a rate of 10% and you've, you know, racked up thousands of dollars of debt on that card, they can't go back to you and say, okay, now we're going to charge you 20% on that debt, unless you've been late on that debt by over 60 days. Now, they can charge you higher rates for new debt, but for that old debt, they can't switch the rules unless you're very, very late.
Okay, so Alvin, one of the things that many people have talked about is how credit cards end up affecting your credit score.
Oh, yes.
And this bill was expected to address that as well. This is something that a caller had to say about it.
I was talking to Bank of America yesterday because of a letter we received. We have over a 700 credit score, never paid a bill partially, always in full, and they decided to half our credit availability.
Okay, that's Philomena from Westchester. She talked about two things in her
yes.
call. Not only did they chop her available credit in half, but they also made a kind of specious report to the credit reporting company.
That happened to me. I got my credit availability cut almost in half.
Yeah, they've been going through and just widespread saying these people are a group that we view as at risk. They don't tell you why you're at risk. They don't say what reason they're going to do this. They just put you all together and then slash your credit cards, and they have to give no reason for that. I saw this happen in the UK and the U.S., especially at the beginning of the credit crisis, firms like Citibank just whack people's credit lines down to almost nothing. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Does this bill fix that?
No, the bill doesn't really fix that. They can still lower your credit availability. What they can stop, what they can't raise, is your interest on the credit card. But you know, Celeste, I have a statement that I think is always true, whether it's in the credit card industry or the banking industry. Where there is money, there is always creativity. There's somebody out there thinking of another way to get money, and the banks are thinking of that. And what they are going, what we will see, is a period I call fee madness. Everything will cost you something. If you miss a payment and you want your points reinstated on your American Express card, $29, and you have a reinstatement fee. The annual fees are now tiered depending upon which credit card you get. You get fees for virtually everything you want to do on a credit card. That's the way they're trying to make up the money, but that they're losing because they can't increase your interest rates.
So, Beth, one of the big things that's been touted in this particular bill is talking about not overdraft fees, because these aren't checking accounts, but when you go over your limit,
yeah,
that now you
right.
have to sign a statement before they'll let you
right.
go over your limit.
Which is, again, another very good thing, I think, because it used to be, you know, 15, 10 years ago, if you had a credit card, you go to a restaurant and you charge more than you actually, what your you go beyond your credit limit, you get embarrassed, and the waiter says, I'm sorry, you're over your credit limit, and you get embarrassed, and you have to get another card. And now, what they've done in the last 5 years, the credit card company said, hey, we can make even more money by having people go over their credit limits. We'll charge them a fee for it, and we'll be happy if they go over the limit, because we'll charge them higher interest. So now, the good thing about the rule is the only way you can be allowed to go over your limit is to sign a form saying, yes, allow me to go over the limit. So the takeaway is, don't ever opt for the right to go over your credit limit, because it's too costly. And there's just one thing I want to say is that I think the most important point of this is what Alvin started to say, and you were saying, Celeste, it is so crazy complicated. I mean, I read these articles. It's crazy. You have to watch what interest rate your variable rate card is pegged to. The bottom line to all of this is, don't carry a balance on your credit card. Don't spend the money you don't have. If you follow that rule, if you try to pay it down and don't live beyond your means, you don't have to pay attention to most of these details. It's true. Some credit card companies are cutting people off. People with great credit scores, great credit histories. But if you're not living right to the edge, not living beyond your means, then that won't affect you as much. So the point of all this is, don't rely on your credit card to live your life.
Beth Koblenzer, Takeaway contributor, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. And Alvin Hall, also a Takeaway contributor. He's also author of Your Money or Your Life, and he's the host of the new BBC World News TV series, Alvin's Guide to Good Business. Thanks to both of you for being with us. You can give us your credit card stories and frustrations by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And speaking of frustration, we're starting a new series this week about frustration with Congress. It's called Frustration Nation. We look at the gridlock in Washington and anger coming out of voters.
My name is Tyrone Thorpe from Baltimore. I must say I'm beyond disgusted about how broken and constipated the Senate is. Democrats need to get some spine and some moral fortitude, not even moral fortitude, just political will to really force Republicans. And if it was up to me, I'd have all them folks out and reseated.
Give us your takes at 877-8-MY-TAKE or our website, thetakeaway.org. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
The White House says a proposal to give the government the power to regulate health insurance premiums is part of President Obama's attempt to rescue the health care overhaul. The proposal is to be officially unveiled later today. Meanwhile, the Afghan government says it's unacceptable that civilians were killed in a NATO airstrike in southern Afghanistan on Sunday. It says at least 27 people, including women and children, were killed. A spokesman for the Afghan government, Hakeem Asher, says this.
We are deeply concerned about civilian casualty in Afghanistan. Actually, this is unacceptable for the government of Afghanistan.
Here at home, military chiefs will be testifying before Congress on whether gays should be able to serve openly in the military, the so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell law. Congress is deciding whether to repeal that legislation. And a big day in Vancouver yesterday. After half a century, the U.S. hockey team beat Canada 5-3. And in alpine skiing, Bodie Miller took a gold medal. The U.S. success at the Olympics is inspiring this young ice skater in New York in Central Park, 8-year-old Martin Fierro.
I look at all the tricks and neat things they do, and I use them.
Abroad and at the United Nations, this called for urgent action to prevent toxic waste from discarded electronic goods. It says many countries, including Mexico, face rapidly growing mountains of e-waste from computers, mobile phones, and other appliances that have been thrown away.
And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we'll talk about the U.S.'s unexpected win against Canada in men's hockey. That's coming up in just a few minutes.
Unexpected, but fabulous.
Hey, you want that to go?
Good morning, Todd Zwillick here, filling in for John Hockenberry for part of this week. We want to get to some takeouts on news stories we're following earlier in the week. Our first is an update from Washington with Jay Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine. Hey, Jay.
Hey, Todd.
Good morning. Well, the White House has released a couple of details of a new proposal from President Obama cracking down on insurance companies.
Well, it's not the first time they've gone after insurance companies in this legislation, but it's certainly the most surprising turnaround. And it's interesting that this is obviously the first time the president is introducing a plan, which is surprising to a lot of people. You've heard about the president's plan all year. This is actually the first time he's introducing a plan, and he's really taking advantage of the news and going after sort of these big rate increases and saying we're going to prevent these and we're going to regulate you.
So giving the government the power just to say no, you can't raise rates?
Well, it basically does that, yeah. It basically says we're going to have the Secretary of Health and Human Services sit down every year, see how much you're proposing to raise your rates, and if it's unjustified, if it doesn't meet the cost of medical inflation, then no, we're not going to allow you to do it.
What do you think is the politics of this? Why go after these companies?
Look, they're trying to find a way to pay for this. My understanding is that most likely the Cadillac tax, the excise tax that was in agreement with the labor unions is probably not going to be in this bill, and they're going to need to find another way to pay for it. This is one way that might bring a little bit more revenue from the health insurers.
Trying to find a way to raise billions for health reform and more debate in Washington this week on healthcare. Time Magazine's Jay Newton Smalls. Thanks, Jay.
For our next takeout, we go to Vancouver with Jason Stallman from our partner, the New York Times. At the end of a hard-fought hockey game last night between the U.S. and Canada, here's how it sounded.
3-for-3 in the preliminary round. The United States has defeated Canada 5-3. Handshakes of guys who know each other well, because these are all NHLers.
So, Jason, unbelievable game last night, and an even more unbelievable upset. The United States beat Canada.
Absolutely surprising. 30 years to the day after Miracle on Ice, that's where we are right now. And last night, the United States pulled off a really compelling upset over Canada and completely deflated the Canadian Olympic fans here. Walking home last night after the game from the press center to my hotel, just thousands of Canadian fans out in the streets, just completely dejected.
If I wasn't so happy about the men's win, I would feel bad for the Canadian fans. But it's 30 years since the Miracle on Ice, but America hasn't beat Canada in hockey since 1960.
It has been a while, and certainly nobody expected it to happen last night. Canada has a virtual all-star team, and they're expected to roll right through to the medal round, and here they are having to play in what's considered a qualification playoff. They basically have to play an extra game now against Germany, and if they win that, they have to play Russia, which many consider to be the best or the second best team in the world. So not an easy road at all for Canada now.
Oh, and let's talk about skiing now. Bodie Miller, he already has the most Olympic medals of any American skier, and he got another one yesterday.
He did. So he's got, three events here in Vancouver up at Whistler, and three medals, bronze, silver, and a gold. Here's a guy who many people wrote off his career after a disastrous Turin Olympics 4 years ago, kind of quietly made his way to Vancouver for the Winter Games again, and has another medal haul. And now with his gold medal, that was the final piece of the puzzle for his career. He has the World Cup victories. He has bronze and silver Olympic medals. Now he finally has a gold. So his name is certainly going to be mentioned among the best ever.
Good for him. Jason Stallman is the Olympic editor for our partner, the New York Times.
For our last takeout now, we want to turn to you. Sure, all the rage is hockey right now, but we realize that not everyone cares about sports. So we devoted last Friday's talk about movies to the best sports films for sports haters, and we got some great recommendations for films you were not planning to be a fan of.
This is Dale Davidson from Manhattan in New York, and I remember that Hoop Dreams was an amazing film that I really didn't expect to like.
And now I want to, play in the NBA like anybody else would want to be. That's something I think about all the time, playing in the NBA.
It really knocked my socks off.
From basketball to baseball, Liz posts on our website, thetakeaway.org, a league of their own, a great story about whether you like baseball or not.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Oh. Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
This is Bruce Pulver. I'm calling from Atlanta, Georgia. The movie that I didn't think I'd like that I ended up liking was Legend of Bagger Vance.
I see the field, but it's 445 yards long. It's got a little red flag at the end of it. It's 12 strokes ahead of him. Come on.
Not typically a fan of golf movies with actors playing, but I think you guys did a great job and told a great story.
Just give me the club.
So some great recommendations from lots of people at 8778MyTake and our site, thetakeaway.org. But, well, not everybody that called had learned to love sports movies.
This is Patricia from Cliffside Park, New Jersey. I hate sports and sports movies so much that when I watch a Harry Potter film and they get to the part about that silly Quidditch game...
Come on, Harry. We've got a game to win.
My eyes glaze over and I go over my grocery list in my head till that part of the movie is passed.
I even skip those parts in the books. Go to our website and you can get more recommendations and see a listener's poll about their favorite sports movie for sports haters. The winner by a big, wide margin, Bull Durham.
What the hell's going on out here?
Well, Nuke Spirit, because his eyelids are jammed and his old man's here. We need a live, was it a live rooster? We need a live rooster to take the curse off Jose's glove, and nobody seems to know what to get Millie or Jimmy for their wedding present. Is that about right?
You can get more recommendations on sports movies for sports haters at thetakeaway.org.
And from sports films to the real sports world, Celeste has a blog post on the website about Tiger Woods and his newfound devotion to Buddhism. It's worth a read for sure, even for people who hate sports. That's at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we'll be talking about what's making headlines in the week ahead. It's Monday, and that means the agenda. It's coming up in just a few minutes.
You know, the Dalai Lama commented about Tiger Woods, says he didn't actually know, he'd never heard of Tiger Woods, but it sounds like he needs self-discipline.
I think he's heard of him now. Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry for part of this week. Coming up, we'll look at the news ahead. It's Monday, and it's the agenda. That's in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 31 minutes past the hour. For the first time later this morning, we're getting a look at President Obama's comprehensive health care overhaul proposals. They'll be posted on the White House website at 10 o'clock Eastern, and we're learning the president's bill would grant federal authorities the power to limit rate hikes by insurance companies. This comes ahead of Thursday's televised summit with Republicans over health care policy. First Lady Michelle Obama tells CBS News this morning it's time to put the partisanship aside.
We can't afford to give up. Not in this country. You know, we're already seeing premiums going up for people who do have insurance, and there are still millions of Americans that are underinsured or uninsured.
Later this morning, the president will meet with several governors to hear their health care ideas.
In Afghanistan, the government says a NATO airstrike has killed at least 27 civilians. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Tom Shanker, Pentagon correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. He told us civilian casualties takes the steam out of the offensive in Marja.
It's all about shifting perceptions of the Afghan population to support their government.
NATO Commander General Stanley McChrystal has apologized to Afghan President Hamid Karzai for the incident. Meanwhile, across the border in Iran, the head of the country's nuclear program says this morning Iran hopes to begin construction on two new uranium enrichment facilities within a year. He says they'll build them deep inside mountains to protect them from possible attack. This comes as Israel rolled out its first unmanned drone aircraft. It's the size of a 757 and capable of reaching Iran. And let's check in on the markets. Asian markets are up. European indices are mixed, though, and futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,402. The S&P opens at 1,109. And the Nasdaq starts at 2,243. Those are some of the stories you're watching this morning.
Hey, what's happening?
Our government.
Issues that are of mutual interest.
Criminal acts as opposed to acts of war.
Working through questions.
Carrying forward this important war.
Monday mornings on The Takeaway, we take a look at the week ahead in the agenda segment, what's going on ahead in the news this week. We were joined earlier this morning by Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and by Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. We began with Afghanistan, where a NATO airstrike killed a number of Afghan civilians yesterday. This took place in Uruzgan province against a suspected convoy of insurgents, and the Afghan cabinet is now saying up to 27 civilians were killed in that attack. I spoke to Jonathan Marcus about the incident this morning.
Well, the latest is clearly that this is a bit of an own goal, if you like, by NATO. General Stanley McChrystal has made it clear that protecting civilians is now the key thrust of the alliance effort in Afghanistan. Every time, unfortunately, civilians are killed by NATO forces, that is, of course, problematic. So he's apologized, as you heard there, to the Afghan President Hamid Karzai. A full investigation is underway. But, you know, this is a hell of a difficult problem. If you make collateral damage, as it's sometimes known, avoiding the deaths of civilians, the yardstick of your military operation. Clearly, with the extraordinary capacity today to target things very precisely and very quickly, very often, unfortunately, the intelligence doesn't quite keep up with that sophisticated capability. And it may be in this case, we don't know yet, but it may be in this case, as in others, that it's the basic intelligence that was at fault, not the targeting. The targeting, sadly, worked all too well.
And just last week, there were a dozen civilians killed in the offensive in Marja. Let's hear from General David Petraeus over the weekend on how the offensive is going in Marja.
This is just the initial operation of what will be a 12 to 18 month campaign, as General McChrystal and his team have mapped it out.
Jonathan Marcus, turning to Marja now, where the U.S. offensive continues. What can we expect over the next week or two as a sort of a, the U.S. forces have described it as a proof of concept?
Well, look, this is very much the new policy. It's to retake these areas and then to stay in them, handing over as much as possible to Afghan military, Afghan police units. I think it's clear that the Taliban are emerging now from the undergrowth. They weren't around too much in the early stages of this operation. So clearly the American commanders are going to want to defeat them. One of the difficulties, I think, of this operation is it has to an extent shown the continuing limitations of the Afghan forces. That's no surprise to anybody. All of the heavy lifting is being done by the American and the British and the other NATO forces. I think the fascinating thing is going to be how capable, how effective will the Afghan police be once these areas are secured in actually enabling daily life to begin again, to get some sense of progress for ordinary Afghan civilians living in those areas. And that really is the key test for this operation as the weeks and months continue.
Well, we want to turn domestically now. Lots going on in the Congress and in Washington, here in the U.S. Marcus Mabry, international business editor for the New York Times. Hearings on Toyota and recalls this week in Congress. The president of Toyota showing up to testify. What are you looking for?
We expect to see a real clash of cultures here. Akio Toyota, the CEO of Toyota, testifying on Wednesday before the House committee. Japanese CEOs are not usually called to account. This is something that we are used to seeing a lot here in the U.S. This is something that does not happen in Japan. Hence, Toyota's incredibly ham-fisted kind of handling of the recalls to date, kind of these successive recalls they've had to do. So this is going to be a real clash of cultures, and he's not going to be comfortable. He'll be very polite in a kind of very Japanese cultural way, but it's not clear what he's going to do about it. The fact is Toyota is not good at responding to regulators. In Japan, they're very lightly regulated, hence many of these problems. And with this latest document coming out showing that Toyota, like any company, was bragging about it internally, the fact that they were able to limit their liability and their cost rather than doing a full recall, that's going to be a real problem for him.
Not going to be surprised to see a fair amount of grandstanding on the part of lawmakers at those hearings. And also, there's been plenty of grandstanding on health care, and there's going to be some health care news this week as the president says he's trying to break through the grandstanding.
Well, this is really going to be it. This is the kind of made-for-television legislating on Thursday, which is, it's not clear it's going to actually produce health care reform or get it off the mark, but it's clear that the president's health care reform effort is in trouble.
Now, we're talking about the health care summit that the president wants to hold with Republicans on TV.
Absolutely. And yeah. Republicans, well, Mitch McConnell said that he'll be there and his members will be there, so we take him at his word. We assume there will be a televised summit. But the problem is that the White House has to keep the momentum going here. They have to keep a sense that this is still alive, that just because there are, they no longer have a supermajority in the Senate, that everything's dead. Because that is the growing suspicion out there. And we have to see if this is about substance, if the White House can actually bring some Republicans to the table and seem like they can actually have some kind of health care reform, or if this is about politics and just the president trying to feel like he's not a total lame duck. The Republicans will be in a hard position, too. They can't look like the party of no, who are totally standing in the way. If the president's smart, he'll align himself with those governors who are in Washington today, saying that, they need, like the president, their executives, they need to have movement. Legislators don't necessarily need to have movement.
Looks like he might be smart because he's speaking to him today. Let's go overseas in our last minute. Jonathan Marcus from the BBC. India and Pakistan have some talks going on that I want to catch up with you about in the wake of the Mumbai attack 15 months ago. What are they talking about?
Well, it's crucial, isn't it, that India and Pakistan improve their relationships. That's an important element of this whole puzzle in the region that brings in Pakistan's relationship with Afghanistan, America's relationship with both countries, and so on. So it is important that ties do improve there, and therefore I think everyone is going to be watching these talks very carefully.
Jonathan Marcus from the BBC joined us this morning, along with Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. Well, coming up in the show, we talk about family life like we do every Monday, and today we have a topic that's hit very close, hit close to home for you, Celeste, blending families. You're about to blend your family with another family, your child with another. So this topic is hitting close to Celeste. How do you blend families? And it's a big issue for kids. Also, Celeste, you're going to be running this segment. Also, Celeste, you have a blog post on Tiger Woods and Buddhism.
A small Buddhist lesson on the takeaway.org.
Celeste is a Buddhist, and she has a Buddhist lesson for Tiger Woods. Check it out on takeaway.org.
That's the lesson. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry for part of this week. There is a lot going on at the Olympics on the ice. Men's hockey, women's hockey, rolling over their opponents, figure skating and ice dancing, and 26.3 million viewers tuning into primetime broadcast. Well, we at The Takeaway have been wondering what impact this burst of enthusiasm for winter sports is having on the American public. People are inspired by Evan Lysacek's gold medal performance. So Femme Oke, our own Takeaway correspondent, went off to Woolman Ice Rink in Central Park in New York. Femi, what did you find out when you went there?
And also former skater. Good morning, everybody. Nice to see you. So Woolman Ice Rink is a very famous ice rink. It is in Central Park, the southern part of Central Park. It's one of the most famous ice rinks in the whole of the world. If you look at the takeaway.org, you'll see some of the pictures I took there yesterday morning. The U.S. Federation, the governing body for all of U.S. figure skating, is the body that looks after all of figure skating in the whole of the U.S. Their biggest program is actually at this ice rink, so it's a really good place to go. 4,000 skaters in the academy, 70 teachers. So I asked the young people there yesterday morning, are they watching the Olympics? What impact is it having on them?
I watch the Olympics. I replay it to see how they get up and jump and how they recover from falls.
Well, they like to act out the performances, that's for sure. They, the family room becomes an ice skating rink, let's just say that much.
I look at all the tricks and neat things they do, and I use them, and that's how I improve my skating.
Now that's a couple of inspired kids there you met on
the ice. That's Sophie, and then also we have little Martin Fierro there, 8 and 9 years old. They're very inspiring. I'm thinking, well, obviously the kids are enjoying the skating, but how do we get data and hard figures? Really, is watching skating on TV during the Winter Olympics, does that have a bump in terms of membership? And Susie Worley is the Senior Director of Membership for US Figure Skating. She calls what happens during the Olympics the Olympic buzz.
The year after the Olympics, our basic skills membership normally increases between 11 and 40%. So that is what we have seen historically. So every 4 years, our membership receives quite a nice bump.
We've seen all these stars in the past. She talks about a nice bump. We've seen stars like Sasha Cohen, gigantic skating stars. Do we have stars now that are inspiring the bump, as she describes it?
Well, Evan Lysacek, obviously, all the kids wanting to be like him, particularly the little boy skaters. But what was really interesting, I spoke to a pro skater called Wendy Wilkie, and she's a coach at the Olympic rink there at Woolman Ice Rink. And she says that the biggest bump ever for skaters were two skaters that you probably might not think of initially, and that takes us back to 1994.
A long time ago, when everyone was watching the Nancy Kerrigan, Tonya Harding, that one year, I saw more kids and more skaters come to the rink than any other Olympic year. And if you ask some of the other coaches, they'll say the same thing. People before that year, I think if you said the word axle, they thought would think you were talking about a car. But after that year, they understood it could either be a car or a jump in the air.
Or a jump in the air. Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding carries other connotations. But Femi, before we go, how's your axle?
Have you heard of a triple axel?
I have.
And a double toe loop.
And you can do both?
I can do neither.
You can do neither.
But watch this afternoon. We have Merrill Davis and Charlie White from US Team America. They are skating their pants off this afternoon. And they're number two so far in the original dance.
Great sound from Central Park, Femi. Okay, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with Todd Zwillick, who is filling in for John Hockenberry, at least until Thursday. We talk about families every Monday, and today we're talking about blended families. You know, the regular divorce rate for marriages in the United States is about 50%, but if you bring kids into that, kids from a prior marriage, it goes up to about 60%. We're going to be discussing this issue and how it relates to me in just a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The president posts health care proposals on the White House website within the next 2 hours. That's ahead of a bipartisan meeting on Thursday. The president will also be meeting later with state governors to talk about education. He wants states to better prepare students for college and careers. The commander of the international forces in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, says he's extremely saddened by the loss of innocent lives after a NATO airstrike left civilians, including women and children, dead. A member of Afghanistan's parliament, Shukriya Barakzai, said accidental killings like this only help the Taliban.
33 people, civilian casualty, just only today in Uruzgan. It's not really acceptable because it's very difficult for us to find answer why civilian people are dying.
Here at home now, the daughter of the man who crashed his small plane into an IRS building in Texas is calling his father a hero. Joe Stack's adult daughter, Samantha Bell, told ABC's Good Morning America the plane attack was inappropriate, but she praised her father's anti-government views. She spoke in a telephone interview from Norway, where she lives. People who abuse animals in California may soon find their address and other information posted online. That's because a new state law calls animal abusers to be listed online, like sex offenders. We'll have more on that later in the show. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu, meanwhile, is in Saudi Arabia today, as new government data shows the U.S. demand for Saudi oil went below 1 million barrels a day last year because China's imports from Saudi Arabia went up to 1 million barrels a day. Javier Blas is from the Financial Times. He joins us from London. Javier, why is U.S. consumption of Saudi oil dwindling?
It's a combination of two factors. The first one is the recession. The recession is getting the U.S. where no government policy since Jimmy Carter has been able to get it, breaking the addiction to foreign oil. And the second factor is that reliance on other countries, in particular Canada, is increasing at a very high speed.
Now, do we then expect when the economy improves for our reliance on Saudi oil just to go right back up, or is there a prospect for keeping it down?
I think that it's a big prospect for keeping it down. For once, the U.S. oil demand for oil is not expected to rebound so much, even if the economy rebounds, because people are getting used to consume less oil. In second, the reliance from other sources than Saudi Arabia is going to continue. We are expecting more oil coming from Canada and also more oil coming from Africa. So even if the economy rebounds in this year and in 2011, probably we have seen the most of the U.S. reliance from Saudi oil.
Javier Blas from the Financial Times, thank you for joining us from London. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Roll out of the shadows and find that eventually there we are, where we are, and what we are is still family.
This summer, my family of two will become a family of four. I'm going to be taking on the role of stepmother. My son will have a new stepfather, and there'll be all kinds of step people in my house. We're not alone. There's 65% of remarriages that involve children from a previous marriage. And unfortunately, 60% of remarriages that include kids eventually end in divorce. So how does a blended family improve those odds? Here with his own story and advice is Lamar Tyler. He's co-creator of the award-winning blog blackandmarriedwithkids.com. He joins us from Washington, D.C. And here with us in the studio is Joy Berry. She's a child development expert and best-selling author of more than 250 books that teach children of all ages about life and responsibility. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Lamar, let's start with you. You and your wife married about 5 years ago. She had a 3-year-old and a 12-year-old at the time. What did you end up finding to be the biggest challenges for you?
You know, definitely was with our older child, who's a boy. So, with the younger child, of course, she was only 2 years old. So, for pretty much her whole life, I've been dad. You know, I've been there for the older child. And plus, since he was a male and I'm a male, I think of some gender role things there at the same time, where I think he was just used to being, you know, the male in the household. So to have another man come into the household and then have kind of more authority, I think, you know, it was some feeling out of the situation that had to be done on both sides.
Okay, but then you had two more kids after you were married. Was that difficult? Did the kids feel like there was a difference in the way that all the kids were treated?
No, you know, and I think, you know, especially for an older child, again, I think he thought there would be a difference, or he was leery that, you know, there may be some differences in the way I parented, you know, between my biological children and you know, him and my other daughter, but that wasn't the case, and, you know, they all kind of took along to each other, and everybody, you know, gets along well, which I've heard, you know, can be horror stories sometimes, but, you know, worked out well for our family.
Oh, well, good. That's good for you. But, Joy, I'm about to become a stepmother for a 14-year-old girl. Teenage girls can sometimes be trouble anyway. So what's the advice for somebody like me who's about to become a step-parent? How do we make that work?
Well, you know what? I think one of the most important things you can do, Celeste, is to remember that you and your partner are making a decision that's going to impact your family immensely, and that the result of that is that kids sometimes feel out of control. So the more that you can bring them back to a place where they feel they have some control over the situation, the better off you're going to be. And that would include things like family meetings where you sat down and you together decided what the family rules are going to be, what the consequences are going to be for not following those rules, what the responsibilities that each family member is going to have, and also what's everyone's role. And the more you bring your kids in on those decisions, the more committed they're going to be to making them work. And instantly, just a little thing about girls and how difficult that is. You know, it's very interesting because the same sex, mother, you know, stepdaughter, whatever, or son, stepfather, those are the real difficult relationships. Because
we've got both of those.
Yeah. Well, okay, because you know what? What happens is that your stepdaughter has something that you want. You have something that she wants. She's got the unconditional love. But, you know, you've got the he wants to spend time with you. And there's a built-in automatic kind of a competitive situation. And the same goes for the stepfather and the stepson. So it's very, very important that you're aware of that and that you start working through those kinds of things. And you know what's really important too is the thing that kids fear the most is just losing their whole sense of self in this expanded family.
Getting lost, right?
Yeah. So it's so important that you continue to give your son some individual attention, and that your partner continues to give his daughter individual attention, so that
separate.
They can, you know, feel very, you know, still autonomous and individual.
That Joy Berry is a child development expert. But Lamar Tyler, this is something that you not only have written about on your blog, blackandmeredithkids.com, but you've experienced for yourself. And, you know, this statistic, 60% of remarriages that involve kids ending in divorce, how do you avoid that? How do you
staggering.
Stop that?
From,
yeah.
Staggering.
Well, see, okay, here's the thing. Todd was really surprised by that.
Yeah.
I wasn't surprised because
it's very credible.
Yeah.
That's very believable.
Yeah, because it's already, people get divorced a lot anyway, but when you add kids in, it becomes more complicated. So, Lamar, how do you keep that from happening?
I think we've really taken a focus to develop our relationship, you know, and always talk about things going on with the kids. But like I said, really just to focus on what's going on between me and my wife, Ronnie, you know, and to keep building our relationship. You know, last time we talked about how, you know, we make it a priority to still date and still, you know, have those private times away from the kids, away from all the kids. We can just develop our relationship further. This summer, we're going down to a conference down in Orlando, Smart Marriages, you know, where we can get more education and get, you know, what we need is the tools to kind of deal with these type of things. And I think a lot of times people don't kind of take advantage of the tools that are out there to help you cope.
That's Lamar Tyler. He's co-creator of the award-winning blog blackandmeredwithkids.com. He's also the director of the films Happily Ever After, A Positive Image of Black Marriage, and You Saved Me. We also talked to Joy Berry. She's a child development expert, best-selling author of more than 250 books that talk about life and responsibility for kids. Thanks to both of you.
Now, if you missed anything on the show, we're always on here on The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. And while you're there, we have some bonuses. Celeste wrote a blog post about Tiger Woods and his newfound devotion to Buddhism. It's worth a read, and that's at thetakeaway.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter to find out what we're planning for the next day's show. Find the link also at thetakeaway.org. And we start a new series this week. We're calling it Frustration Nation. We examine the gridlock in Congress and the roiling anger being expressed by voters. Are you frustrated with how the government's running in Washington?
Andy, Mamaroneck, New York. I'm disgusted with most all the politicians in Washington, and 8 times out of 10, I'm going to vote for somebody who is not in office, not an incumbent.
Not an incumbent. Well, tell us your take at 8778MyTake or post to the website again. That's thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry for a few more days. This is The Takeaway. That's the sound of Washington right now. Gridlock on climate change and the economy, and of course, healthcare. A lot of Democrats are squirming in their seats.
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
No!
Now, for a lot on the right, gridlock is just fine. Here's Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, probably a presidential candidate for 2012. Just this weekend, he said he'd like to see Washington get about as far as a Tiger Woods SUV.
She said, no more. I think we should take a page out of her playbook and take a 9-iron and smash the window out of a big government in this country.
When someone's swinging a 9-iron at your car, do you get out and cause a traffic jam or just hit the gas and go faster? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 22nd. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry for the better part of this week. I'm here with Celeste. You know, Celeste, the takeaway for me is gridlock is frustrating to a lot of people, but for people who don't like the president's agenda, and there are millions of them, gridlock might be a good thing. It slows him down.
Well, I'm a student of history, and for me the question is, when does gridlock actually work to make things better? Going to ask that question in a few minutes, I guess. Let's get right to the top stories this morning. Hoping to jumpstart the stalled health care bill, President Obama wants to give federal authorities the power to stop excessive rate hikes by insurance companies. That idea, along with the rest of his plan to overhaul health care, will be posted on the White House website for the first time in about an hour. This comes ahead of Thursday's televised meeting between Democrats and Republicans about health care.
A new poll this morning shows 86% of Americans believe the government is broken. All week, we're continuing a series called Frustration Nation. We'll take a look at the gridlock in Washington. Right now, we're joined by Julian Zelizer, a congressional historian. He's at Princeton University. Julian, gridlock seems to be so bad, and everyone seems to think it's the worst they've ever seen. Is that right? When we look back in history, really, is this the worst we've ever seen it?
No, I think sometimes we exaggerate how bad things are, meaning, you know, there are certain aspects of politics that aren't working well. We filibuster too much, so it seems you need 60 votes on everything. But if you look at a period like the 1960s, Democrats were complaining about the same thing. The committee chairs were blocking legislation. Southerners had been using the filibuster to stop civil rights, and there were all kinds of calls for congressional reform. And you could find that throughout American history. The system itself is kind of built toward gridlock.
The system itself it seems to be built towards moving slowly, but that can be intensely frustrating. Well, we're going to get more historical context with you, Julian Zelizer, so stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
In Afghanistan, the government says a NATO airstrike has killed around 30 civilians. NATO confirms it fired on three minibuses. They believed it was a Taliban convoy. Lieutenant General Nick Parker is deputy commander of NATO-led forces in Afghanistan.
If we kill the people that we're actually trying to protect, our credibility is undermined, and therefore it is critical to us to avoid these sort of incidents occurring.
NATO Commander General Stanley McChrystal has apologized to Afghan President Hamid Karzai for the incident. Here at home, new credit card rules go into effect today. Companies won't be able to raise interest rates on existing balances.
Last night at the Olympics, U.S. men's hockey did something they haven't done in 50 years. They beat Canada in the Olympics. U.S. team captain Jamie Langebrunner says everyone contributed to the 5-3 win.
We had a pretty solid team effort tonight. We weathered some of their play where they were controlling it, but we did a good job of that, and we're able to battle through.
Now, also, American alpine skier Bodie Miller won his first gold medal yesterday. Coming up later in the hour, we talk more hockey because 3 decades ago, it was the Miracle on Ice, U.S. over the Soviet Union. One of the guys on that team is now the coach of U.S. women's hockey, so stay tuned for that interview later in the show. He's going to be joining us. Turning to the markets now, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,402, and the S&P opens at 1,109. The NASDAQ opens at 2,243.
And we do start this new series this week, Frustration Nation, about the gridlock in Congress. And we're wondering, what do you think? Are you frustrated by what's going on in Washington right now? Let us know at 8778MyTake, or you can post at our website, thetakeaway.org.
There is much too much ideology, not enough practical progress.
People are angry,
and they are frustrated that perhaps it hasn't been a fast enough change.
Even at a time of enormous national challenge, the people's business is not getting done.
I don't want you to feel discouraged.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Well, a new CNN poll finds that 86% of Americans think that government is broken. With so much anger over the state of politics right now, both inside and outside the Beltway in Washington, we're launching a series this week we're calling Frustration Nation. We want to examine the gridlock in Congress and in Washington and the state of disenchantment among the electorate. Last week, longtime Democratic Senator Evan Bayh announced he would not be running for re-election because, well, frankly, he's one of those 87%.
For some time, I've had a growing conviction that Congress is not operating as it should. There is much too much partisanship and not enough progress. Too much narrow ideology and not enough practical problem solving.
Well, that was interesting coming from Evan Bayh because he's not only a two-term senator himself, but his father was a senator. So he has seen how it works in his time. He saw how it worked when he was a boy in his father's time. And he says he's just about fed up, so much so that he doesn't want to work there anymore. Part of his reason anyway. Well, to kick off this series, we're joined today by Theda Scotchpole. She's professor of government and sociology at Harvard University. And back with us, Julian Zelizer, congressional historian at Princeton and author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II. To the War on Terror. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks.
Nice to be here.
Good morning, Theda. Let me start with you. So many people say this is as bad as they've seen it. Evan Bayh strongly implies and has said this is as bad as he's seen partisanship and gridlock. What do you think? As bad as it gets?
Of course, slavery, civil rights, those were issues on which we saw protracted minority obstruction. I think it is pretty bad now in that this is the first time we have seen a minority, after an election that their party lost badly, decide to obstruct virtually everything in the program of a popular president.
Go ahead. This is new. Julian, you say it's not so new, that we've been around this merry-go-round before, that Washington is designed to move slowly.
Well, it's designed to move slowly, but we also reach periods where the system is kind of grinding to a halt, and presidents or congressional leaders start to feel great frustration, and it often leads to moments of reform. Again, the 1960s, ironically, when Lyndon Johnson can move legislation, is also one where a lot of this frustration is building up. But clearly, there are certain issues that are getting worse. The filibuster is one. Campaign finance reform is one. And a sort of scorched earth obstructionist policy by the Republicans is the final one.
How did we get here to scorched earth, Julian? Is it just a question of the ideas are so big? Let's take health care. The ideas are so big. There's so much money at stake that rather than let it pass, you have to get scorched earth. How do you think we got to this moment?
Well, part of it is kind of a incremental deterioration of the political battles between the two parties. And I do think, you know, there's a sense of seeing how far you can push these obstructionist mechanisms, and that's what we're seeing with the Republican Party. Part of it is just built-up tension over the last two decades of pretty big partisan polarization. And it seems, again, that the parties keep taking this further and further. And the Republicans are clearly kind of greatly frustrated that the story didn't turn out the way they wanted with united control of government in the early part of the 21st century.
Now, Theda Scotchpole from Harvard, one of the things that I hear from members of Congress about why their relationships are so bad, some of it's interpersonal. They don't spend time together anymore. They fly home every weekend. They don't have a drink together. They don't have dinner together. Do you think that's – how much of a role do you think that plays?
I think it plays a little role, but I actually think that the reason that the Republicans have turned to across-the-board obstructionism on everything, including the appointments to the president's administration, is because it works. It works in an era of 24-hour cable news where Americans just pick up sound bites. Most Americans have no idea that it takes 60 votes in the Senate to pass something. They think we voted for a party to try some new things, and nothing is happening. And remember, this is happening in a severe economic recession where millions of Americans have lost their jobs or are afraid of losing them, and think that the only thing the parties can do together is bail out Wall Street.
Julian Zelzer, I'm curious. One analyst had said that what sets us apart from other historical eras of obstructionism is that the obstructionism is across the board. In other words, there's not just opposal to, on standards to civil rights or integration or segregation, but that even very routine, what would normally be routine legislation, gets blocked on principle.
I think that's a fair comment, and you can see that in the filibuster, meaning we've had a filibuster or filibusters throughout much of the history of the Senate. We didn't have cloture rules until early 20th century, but the filibuster was reserved in much of the 20th century for high-profile issues. So for something like civil rights, the filibuster was employed, and now what you see is the threat of a filibuster is used on almost anything, small legislation, big legislation, and I do think that is a significant change, and it's a bigger story about kind of using obstruction everywhere, especially in the last, you know, few months, rather than just in some places.
Theda Scotchpole, if obstruction works in the modern age, whether it's media or in the jet age of Congress, and it's going to influence voters to throw the bums out, and in this case the bums are Democrats, what's the way out of this? How about a little bit of a roadmap here, how to end the obstruction? And the gridlock.
You know, I'm not sure there is a way out of this. And if Democrats are thrown out because Republicans cynically used across-the-board obstruction, that will not produce the result that voters will want. One of the problems that can happen, and it's happened in some European systems with fragmented parties, is that everybody obstructs, and then you get everything ground to a halt. On the other hand, if Democrats get back in, we'll see a lot of pressure on them to cooperate with the tax cuts for the rich that the Republicans want to put through. And in fact, in the past, they have let those through with less than 60 votes.
Theda Scotchpole, professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, and Julian Zelizer, congressional historian at Princeton University and author, joining us to talk about obstruction in Congress. You know, I had an interesting conversation with conservative Republican Congressman Jeff Fortenberry from Nebraska about why he thinks relations are dysfunctional between him and his colleagues. He's got an interesting take, so listen to it at thetakeaway.org. It's up there right now. We'll be continuing the series all week on Frustration Nation. We want to hear what you think about gridlock in Washington. 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post to the website at thetakeaway.org. Now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on some of the stories we're following.
The president will be posting details of his new health care proposals in the next hour. Earlier this morning, First Lady Michelle Obama, speaking on CBS's Early Show, said the health care bill has to be passed.
We can't afford to give up, not in this country. You know, we're already seeing premiums going up for people who do have insurance, and there are still millions of Americans that are underinsured or uninsured.
Republicans and Democrats meeting at the White House on Thursday will discuss these new proposals. The Afghan government says it's unacceptable that civilians were killed in a NATO airstrike in southern Afghanistan on Sunday. It says at least 27 people, including women and children, were killed.
In Europe now, officials at the German national airline Lufthansa are asking a court to end the pilot strike that has left thousands of travelers stranded. The dispute centers on the transfer of jobs to foreign subsidiaries. The company hopes to have a court ruling by tomorrow. Internal memos at Toyota show officials bragged about saving the company $100 million by negotiating a limited recall in 2007 with U.S. regulators. Congressional hearings are set this week on Toyota's current global recall. Meanwhile, the U.N. has called for urgent action to prevent toxic waste from being discarded from electronic goods. It says many countries, including Mexico, face rapidly growing mountains of e-waste. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, who are the new poor in America? We talked to the New York Times' Louise Story, who says it might be people who were once middle class. We talk more about that in just a few moments.
Hey, you want that to go?
Yeah, we've got your takeouts on news stories this week. And the first takeout comes from Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. They have their first article in a new series that examines the new poor. So, Louise, let's start there. Who are the new poor? New with a capital N.
The new poor in this series are the people who were comfortably in the middle class before the Great Recession that we have been going through began. And they're people who have now been unemployed for a long time. You know, there are more than 6 million people who have been unemployed for more than 6 months, which is the highest level since this stuff has been tracked, since the numbers of long-term unemployed have been tracked. And there's real questions about these formerly middle-class people, if they will ever get back to the middle class, because we don't know if there'll be job creation strong enough to take all these people back.
Well, we've been actually been the country and economists have been talking about the death of the middle class, the possible death of the middle class, for a very long time. Is that actually what we're seeing, or is this kind of, we don't know yet?
So what happens is every recession we've had in the last 20 years has gutted the middle class more and more. We're moving away from the 1950s. When you look at the figures, before 1990, it took about 21 months after a recession for the jobs that were lost to come back. In the 1990 recession, it took 31 months. In the 2001 recession, it took 46 months. It's taking longer and longer. This recession, 15 million unemployed. We don't know if they'll come back. And that's really because our economy is increasingly not a workers' economy. This is a profit shareholder return economy. And businesses, as they recover, are going to try to automate and only bring back the workers they really need. They're not going to be out trying to hire the masses.
Okay, Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
For our Nets takeout now, let's check in on Vancouver and the Olympics with Jason Stallman covering the Olympics for our partner, the New York Times. Jason, the ice dancing finals are tonight. We've got Canadians in the lead. We've got Americans in second and fourth place. Looks like we might have some good news for the U.S. on the podium tonight.
Certainly could see some good news for the United States. Perhaps Canada needs it more than the United States does, though, at this point.
On the ice, right.
their Own the Podium program, you know, that Canada sunk millions of dollars into this effort to finish atop the overall medals table, and the United States has been dominating so far. So, yeah, Canada would love to grab a medal in ice dancing or anything right now.
And staying on the ice, of course, women's hockey semifinals. What are the two matchups we have coming up?
Well, you have the United States playing Sweden and Canada against Finland. Based on the results so far in round-robin play, it really looks like it's going to be Canada against the United States for a gold medal. This is a sport that boils down to two teams, really. Same sort of thing that happened with women's softball before it was removed from the Olympic program. Two countries are dominating, and everybody else is trying to score a goal here and there.
The United States has been absolutely rolling over its opponents in hockey, sometimes with double-digit scores. We want to point out that later this morning, we're talking to the U.S. women's hockey coach and lead scorer for the 1980 Miracle on Ice team. Today marks the 30th anniversary of that U.S. hockey victory over the USSR in Lake Placid. You'll be able to hear the full interview on our website, thetakeaway.org, right after the show. Jason, thanks for being with us from Vancouver. Jason Stallman covers the Olympics for the New York Times.
And for our last takeout, we turn to California, where it may not be quite so golden for people who abuse animals. It turns out animal abusers could soon be treated like sex offenders in legal ways, anyway. To tell us how that works is Jesse McKinley, San Francisco Bureau Chief for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Jesse.
Good morning.
In what ways are animal abusers in this proposal going to be treated like sex offenders?
Well, the basic concept is that the state, if they could pass this bill and get Arnold Schwarzenegger to sign off on it, would establish an online registry whereby anyone accused of felony-level animal cruelty charge would be listed online, very much in the way of sex offenders, with their name, their home address, their place of employment, and their criminal record.
And who would be looking at this online registry?
It would be open to anyone. Anyone who, you know, has an internet connection could essentially get online and find out if their neighbor had, you know, been convicted of running an animal fighting ring or hoarding or, you know, a variety of felony-level offenses. Now, keep in mind that most animal cruelty charges are actually misdemeanors, and it's somewhat rare for a prosecutor to actually go for a felony charge. But, you know, as we saw in a case like Michael Vick, it certainly does happen.
Yeah, but I guess the operative question here is what about the pound? Are they going to check that registry before they allow someone to adopt an animal? What about a pet store?
Conceivably, that would be one of the uses. In talking to prosecutors about this, particularly with puppy mills, places that generate large numbers of dogs, sometimes illegally, a lot of these people will skip from state to state to state, basically looking for a jurisdiction where they're not going to be prosecuted or not gone after with the same intensity. So backers of this idea think that this would be a great way for people to kind of track these people as they move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Are other states considering doing programs like this?
Tennessee had taken this up in 2008. It got through the Senate. I think it stalled after that. This idea has been around for a little bit. It's been tinkered with. But in California, which has a very strong record of animal rights, laws, in particular Proposition 2, which outlawed battery cages for egg-laying hens. The state's voters have seemed to be very, very much in favor of this, and the backer of this, Dean Flores, who's the Senate Majority Leader, seems to think he's got the votes to get it through.
And, well, you know, we're seeing this kind of thing in other areas of law enforcement. They not only have this for child sex offenders, but they also have John's TV, I've seen in many cities, and now this with animal abusers. Is this perhaps law enforcement trying to use broadened communication to crack down?
Certainly, and I think that for some civil libertarians, this is also somewhat troubling in that it turns people on a level of animal abuse into pariahs. But the backers of this, which include this group called the Animal Legal Defense Fund, feel very strongly that this is simply publishing public records and using that information to kind of keep people aware of who they're living next to or hiring.
Okay, Jesse McKinley is the San Francisco Bureau Chief for our partner at the New York Times. Coming up, we'll continue our coverage of the ongoing Allied offensive in southern Afghanistan and look at how the campaign in Marja differs from a typical military operation and how the word is getting out on PR about that campaign. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Coming up, the military is trying a number of different tactics in this offensive on Marja in southern Afghanistan. We're going to talk to you about those in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the headlines we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. For the first time, we're getting a look at the nuts and bolts of President Obama's plan to overhaul health care. They'll be posted on the White House website in half an hour. A new addition is the president's plan to give federal authorities the power to limit rate hikes by insurance companies. At the top of the hour, you can read the proposals at thetakeaway.org as well as hear reaction to them. This comes ahead of Thursday's televised meeting between Democrats and Republicans about health care. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell tells CBS News Americans are fed up with partisanship.
Sooner or later, you've got to compromise. You've got to start making the compromises that arrive at a consensus and move the country forward.
And from the headlines to you, we're starting this new series this week called Frustration Nation. We're wondering if you're frustrated by what's going on in Washington.
This is Paul from Rhode Island. This attitude, a plague on all politicians, they're all no good. I mean, grow up, people. Who put them there in the first place? Who listened and paid attention to their advertising?
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our website, thetakeaway.org.
A new credit card rules go into effect today. They'll shield you from sudden interest rate hikes. Earlier on The Takeaway, personal finance expert Beth Kobliner told us one key change is that people under 21 can no longer get a credit card without a job or without a parental co-signature.
Up until now, college kids have been bombarded with credit cards. They have, on average, $4,100 in credit card debt. That's not going to happen anymore.
Beatles fans are breathing a sigh of relief. That's because Abbey Road, the London recording studio that made the Beatles famous, is safe. Struggling music company EMI had said last week they may sell Abbey Road. Now, news is that potential buyers are stepping back, and EMI is stepping back. Abbey Road is safe for the moment. Now let's turn to Wall Street. The markets are open. The Dow is up 12 points. The S&P is up 2 points. And the NASDAQ is up about 7 in early trading. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
As we've been reporting all morning, a NATO airstrike has killed a number of civilians in Afghanistan. The Afghan cabinet is now saying 27 people are dead after a strike on a suspected Taliban convoy that turned out to be full of civilians. Chris Morris is a BBC reporter who joined us earlier this morning from Kabul, Afghanistan. And I asked Chris to give us the details of this NATO airstrike.
This is something that happened on Sunday morning, local time. NATO said it thought Taliban insurgents in the province of Uruzgan, which is just north of Helmand, where Operation Mushtarak, the big operation, is taking place, thought the Taliban there were about to attack a joint Afghan and NATO military unit. They called in the airstrike, hitting three minibuses. But when people arrived on the ground, it pretty soon became clear that women and children were among the dead and wounded. The Afghan cabinet's now put out a statement saying initial reports suggest at least 33 people have been killed and that all of them were civilians, and it described the airstrike simply as unjustifiable. I think an indication of the level of anger, understandably in many, many ways, among all sections of Afghan society whenever an incident like this takes place.
That was Chris Morris, BBC correspondent in Kabul, Afghanistan. He joined us earlier this morning. We have with us now Tom Shanker. He's the Pentagon correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. And he's written an analysis of this campaign that details what sets it apart from other offensives. Tom, you wrote about something that I found fascinating. You talked about some polling done in Afghanistan by U.S. officials. That seems strange as part of a military campaign. What is that about?
Well, that's exactly right. You don't really associate military campaigns with polling. That's more a tool of political campaigns. But that just proves how political are the goals of the Marja offensive now underway in Helmand Province. Before the offensive began, the military and other parts of the government did quite a bit of polling in the region to try to find out what the residents thought about the Americans, about the central government, about the insurgents, and what the central government and its U.S. ally could do to make the citizens feel safe and earn their support. Now, to be sure, you know, one can only imagine what the margin of error is when there are entire villages where you risk your life going in, but the military thought this was an important tool to have in hand before the offensive started.
This civilian deaths was specifically one thing that they were trying to avoid in this Marja offensive, and that was new as well. So does this NATO airstrike damage that?
Of course, anytime innocent civilians, noncombatants are killed in a military operation, it undermines the exact goal of what General McChrystal is trying to do, which is to get, you know, the fearful and the fence setters in Afghanistan to move from either supporting the Taliban or a neutral position into supporting the central government. The entire offensive in Marja, you know, yes, it's carried out with bullets and bombs and all of that, but its goal is not, you know, only to kill the adversary or only to seize territory. It's all about shifting perceptions of the Afghan population to support their government. Civilian deaths are absolutely counter to that, and that's why also in advance of Marja, the military signaled long before it came in that the offensive was coming. If all the bad guys had left town, that would have been fine, but they wanted the civilians to get to safe locations in an attempt to minimize the death of noncombatants.
You know, you talked about how for the past 6 months, the military was trying to learn from the Taliban in terms of winning the war for hearts and minds. What kind of strategies or hints did they take from their enemies to work on the civilians?
Well, the real thing that the Taliban can do is they're very agile. They can trumpet their successes on the internet and over the radio and over these kind of threatening night letters that they deliver. The one advantage the Taliban has, of course, is they can lie anytime they want. If the American military puts out a press release that's false, the reporters on the ground will find that out and uncover it, and that too undermines the mission. But what General McChrystal tried to adapt was a strategy of changing the momentum of depicting the central government in Kabul and its partners in the coalition military as winners to try to drown out the Taliban narrative that they were in control.
So how quickly does news travel? Will the people in the city of Marja already know about the NATO airstrike that killed civilians in the province above them?
Yeah, inside the city of Marja, it's doubtful. There's still a full-scale military operation there. But across the rest of Afghanistan, the Oruzgan tragedy is, of course, immediately known.
And in what way can they minimize the damage? Are they doing it right by General Stanley McChrystal immediately apologizing to Hamid Karzai? Is that the right move to take?
That's the new strategy that Secretary Gates imposed about it a year ago. Rather than have the lengthy and long military investigation, when there were examples of civilian deaths, the military would apologize first, investigate later, not the other way around.
Tom Shanker is the Pentagon correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. We're going to see if this new strategy actually works in Marja. In the meantime, if you have anything that you want to share about something you've heard on the show, like Afghanistan, you can tell us.
Tom from Seabrook, New Jersey. At the recent deaths of 30 or so civilians in Afghanistan, come on, Obama, stop killing in my name. You're not accomplishing anything over there that is has anything to do with the safety of Americans. Okay, it might be good for business or globalization, but it's not good for anything else.
You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to the site, thetakeaway.org.
We're also starting a new series this week, Frustration Nation. We examine the gridlock in Congress and the roiling anger from voters. Are you frustrated by how government's running in Washington? What's your solution?
This is Rick Boyer from Detroit, Michigan. I don't buy the vocal minority of people being angry at the politicians in Washington. Everyone says they're angry and they should be removed, but every year the people keep sending the bombs back to Washington.
Now, some of you are getting creative and telling us in just six words.
Build electric cars, fix American economy.
Lauren in Boston,
totally frustrated with this crazy Congress.
Well, tell us your take at 8778-MYTAKER. Post to the website at thetakeaway.org. While you're there, check out an interview I did with Congressman Jeff Fortenberry. He's a conservative Republican, and he has his take from the inside about why relations are so dysfunctional between him and his colleagues.
Coming up, we're going to talk about hockey. Not just the men's victory yesterday over Canada, but 3 decades ago, the U.S. men's hockey team performed the miracle on ice. They beat the Soviet Union. Now one member of that team is hoping for another victory, this time as coach of the U.S. women's team. He's going to join us later for that conversation. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's about this time of year that high school seniors start applying for college. They're filling out applications. They're writing personal essays, collecting those letters of recommendation, and also breaking out the camera phones.
I can apply my hand-eye coordination and make it into something really complex and beautiful, like a piece of music. Or apply it to solving something that can, in the end, be really simple.
Okay, well, you maybe recognize the sound of the piano on one end. That's high school senior Connor Buckley in a video essay that he made. But you may not recognize on the other side, he was actually solving a Rubik's Cube. That's part of a YouTube video essay he made as part of his application to Tufts University. And this was all a brainchild of my next guest, Lee Coffin, the Dean of Undergraduate Admissions at Tufts University in Boston. Dean, you said that the YouTube video idea is causing quite a bit of talk on the campus.
Good morning. It's caused quite a stir, and it's been exciting to watch it play out.
Well, how did you come up with this idea?
Well, the idea hatched almost serendipitously last spring. We were talking about this year's essay questions, and the thought occurred to us that this is a group that was born in 1992. They've lived out their entire life in the internet era, with access to social media and the transparency that comes with it. And we thought maybe there's a new opportunity here to create a different storytelling moment for the applicants. And so we thought let's give them an option to do a 1-minute video posted on YouTube as a way of showing us a new part of themselves that would necessarily come through in a traditional written form.
Is there an income barrier? Is there a certain level of financial stability that a student has to have in order to have access to video equipment?
No, you know, what's been really gratifying to note is about 60% of our video essay submitters have also applied for financial aid. And I think that speaks to the democratization of technology. And so most kids these days have access to a laptop or a camera or a cell phone that has the video capability. And we're not asking students to do Oscar-winning short films. We're saying sit before a camera and tell us about yourself in your own words in a way that gives us a new perspective on who you are. And some of them have been really simple and crude and compelling, and others have been very high-tech and impressive that a high school senior is able to pull that off.
Well, you know, since they're YouTube essays, these are things that everybody has access to and can watch. So do people start lobbying you on who they think should get in?
There has, yes, some lobbyists have sprouted up. Mostly among our undergraduates have stumbled upon the YouTube videos and are posting comments to the admission committee urging us to admit someone. One girl said, you know, if you don't take her, I won't accept my diploma at graduation. And, you know, it's charming. We're not paying any attention to that because the video essay is really one piece of our broader evaluation of a candidate. But it's fun to see the way the videos have both caught the imagination of the applicants but also our current students. And I think it speaks to the way this generation of college students uses video and related social media as another way of expressing themselves.
Okay, he's the Dean of Undergraduate Admissions at Tufts University in Boston. Thanks so much, Lee Coffin.
My name is Amelia Downs, and I'm here to show you how I combine two of my favorite things, being a nerd and dancing.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry, and I'm here with Celeste Headlee. Well, coming up, we're talking hockey because 3 decades ago, U.S. men's hockey team performed what's known as that miracle on ice when they beat the Soviet Union. Now, a member of that team is hoping for another victory in Vancouver, this time as coach of U.S. women's hockey. We're talking to him in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. In the next 15 minutes, the president will be posting the details of his new healthcare proposals for the first time. You can read those proposals and hear a reaction on thetakeaway.org. On Thursday, there's a televised debate between Republicans and Democrats on the new proposals. It's a healthcare summit at the White House. Governor Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania says Republicans need to come to this meeting with an open mind.
They can't just say no on Thursday. The American people are watching, and they're watching clearly. You take some of our ideas, we'll take some of your ideas. We may not love your ideas, but we'll take them.
Later on today, the president will meet with several governors to hear their health care ideas. The Afghan government says it's unacceptable that 27 civilians were killed in a NATO airstrike in southern Afghanistan on Sunday. Lieutenant General Nick Parker is deputy commander of NATO-led forces in Afghanistan.
If we kill the people that we're actually trying to protect, our credibility is undermined. And therefore, it is critical to us to avoid these sort of incidents occurring.
An investigation has been launched into the airstrike.
Here at home, military chiefs will be testifying before Congress on whether gays should be able to serve openly in the military, the so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell law. Congress is deciding whether to repeal that legislation. And with 7 gold and 24 medals overall, the United States leads the medal tallies at the Winter Olympics. Last night was particularly special. You may have missed it. The United States hockey team beat Canada. First time in 50 years.
Could have missed it.
Kind of a big moment. Also in alpine skiing, Bodie Miller took home a gold medal. That's his first. Iran has issued a warning that airlines will be banned from flying into its airspace unless they use the term Persian Gulf to describe that stretch of water that separates Iran from its southern neighbors. We were joined earlier by John Line, BBC Iran correspondent in London, and we asked him, why does the Iran government care what people are calling it?
Well, I can tell you that when I was based in Iran, I did a story once which I thought was pretty heavily critical of Iran's human rights record, and I was quite scared about the response. And the only thing they criticized me for was the fact that I'd called it the Gulf and not the Persian Gulf. It's a matter of huge importance to Iran. They see it, I think, when it's not called that, as an insult to their history and, of course, their 2,500-year-old history and more of the civilization and their culture. And so it is a matter of massive importance to them.
John Lyon is a BBC Iran correspondent. He joined us from London. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Now, U.S. hockey is on a tear in Vancouver. Last night, the men's team upset the Canadians 5-3, and there's some Olympic hockey history in the air this week. Today is the 30th anniversary of one of the biggest upsets in the history of the Olympics and in the history of hockey, when those scrappy college kids from the U.S. men's hockey team beat the USSR, the Soviet Union. Mark Johnson was on that team, and now he's looking for another gold in this Olympics in Vancouver, but this time he's coach of Team USA's women's hockey team. The U.S. women play in the semifinals against Sweden later on today. We spoke with Mark Johnson last week from Vancouver. He was the lead scorer in that magnificent game in 1980, and I asked him if that performance inspires his players now.
Well, hopefully. I mean, not too often as an athlete you get to play in the Olympic Games, and certainly the expectations back in 1980 when we're playing are a little bit different than the team I'm running right now, but it's still the Olympics. It's still an opportunity to represent your country. And for this group of players that I'm coaching, it's an opportunity to win a gold medal. And it's exciting. And certainly we've got a lot of energy within our squad.
You know, the United States women's team has blown by Finland 6-0, blown by Russia 13-0, blown by China 12-1, facing Sweden this afternoon. It's safe to say, I think, that your team has not been well tested yet. So how are you expecting to fare in the rest of the tournament here?
Well, obviously, the next game, as you mentioned, against Sweden, we play this afternoon. It's going to be an important game from the standpoint. If you're victorious and you're successful in that game, you get an opportunity to play for a gold medal. So to me, it's the toughest game of the tournament. Sweden in 2006. Beat the United States in this exact game. So we're going to have our hands full just because of the meaning of the game.
Meanwhile, Sweden itself was blasted by Canada 13-1. What intel do you derive from that result?
Well, obviously, the Canadians have a very strong team. They're playing in their home country, on their home soil, and they got a lot of offensive players that are very dangerous. In sports, you can have good nights and bad nights. And for Canada, they had a very good night against Sweden. And unfortunately, the Swedes didn't play very well. But they'll forget that quickly because, as I mentioned, the team that wins that game between ourselves gets an opportunity to play for a gold medal. So there's a lot on the line. And certainly both teams are going to come out and try to play their best hockey.
Mark Johns, let's take a step back for a minute, because I know you know about the concern about the balance in women's hockey right now. You have teams like the United States, like Canada, really dominating the world, and I just went through some of the results, 13-0 over Russia, 12-1 over China. Of course, Canada rolling over Sweden 13-1 and an even bigger result against Slovakia. There are people out there who want to put Olympic women's hockey on hold until there's better competition for the U.S. and Canada. Would that be a good idea?
No, I don't think it would be. I don't think it'd be fair to certainly several of the countries that are doing things the right way. It's, to me, it's such a new sport. It hasn't been around long enough to warrant the opportunity to say, hey, let's put this on hold and wait a few more years for these other countries to catch up. You go back to the early Olympics, you look at men's ice hockey, the scores were even worse than what you're seeing in the women's side here the last couple of Olympics. Finland's got much better over the last several years. Sweden's doing a nice job. China's starting to make progress. It takes time, and I think sometimes we have to be patient. I know the other countries are working hard. Unfortunately, some of the federations in those areas, aren't putting the resources into it right now, and hopefully in the future it'll continue to grow, it'll continue to prosper, and these countries will continue to improve.
Right. Most people probably don't know that your women play a schedule against high school hockey players for two reasons. One, the speed is kind of matched, but also it's kind of hard to find competition elsewhere in the world right now.
Well, it is, and for us and certainly for Canada, Sweden's done the same thing. Actually, Finland's played against some boys' teams this year.
Right.
When you put together your Olympic rosters, you have the best players that your country has to offer, and so you're looking for competition. And usually that, that 16, 17, 18-year-old boy is probably the right level. You start getting 19 and 20-year-olds in the junior level, and we played a couple of those teams this year. That might be a little bit stretching it. It's good competition, but I think that if you have the best players on the female side, for us to play against boys' high school teams, gives us competition that makes us a better hockey team.
They call your 1980 performance, of course, the miracle on ice when the United States men's team beat the Soviet Union, called the Soviet Union at the time, at Lake Placid. If your women pull out a gold medal here, and we all hope they do, in the 2010 Olympics, would you call it a miracle on ice? Certainly a great achievement, but not quite the same underdog status, not even close to what you all faced against the Soviets.
No, as I mentioned, the expectations of this squad when we started in August is our goal is to win the gold medal. I mean, back in 1980, I don't think any of us on that squad, anyone within our staff was thinking about winning a gold medal. But
right.
This team right I've got right now, we've been preparing, training. They've been working hard. They've committed themselves, for many years here to get this opportunity. And, certainly when the expectations are high, kids work extremely hard, and they're going to put themselves in position. They've prepared, and now there are opportunities in front of them. So this isn't going to be a miracle. This is a lot of time commitment, a lot of work on a lot of people's part.
Yeah, you're right. It's no miracle. It's a lot of hard work. U.S. women's hockey is rolling strong in Vancouver. Three wins under their belt. They play Sweden this afternoon under the leadership of Mark Johnson. He's the coach and also former player of 1980 U.S. men's hockey, the so-called miracle on ice. Mr. Johnson, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
We spoke to Mark Johnson last week, and for more excitement on the Olympics, you can catch all of our coverage. We have interviews with the skaters Vanessa James and Yannick Bonneau, fashion designer Nick Varios talking about costumes, and takeaway correspondent Femi Oké went out to Central Park to talk to young, possibly future Olympic skaters. That's at thetakeaway.org. While you're there, you can sign up for our newsletter as well. We're also starting a new series this week called Frustration Nation. We're wondering if you're frustrated with what's going on in Washington.
This is Walt from Detroit. The Democrats now are them cowards because they're not doing anything. There was an election, and there's 59 of them and 41 Republicans, and they won't do anything. So I'm pretty fed up with the situation that's going on in Washington.
Give us your take, 8778-MY-TAKE, or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're also on that website going to have the details of President Obama's health care reform proposal coming up in just a few minutes. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry. For the next couple of days, this is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.